Well, welcome back to Coast, Dan Rather with us. In the next 30 minutes, we'll take some phone calls with the time remaining. I've got lots to talk with him about. We're going to pick it up with the Saddam Hussein story when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Dan Rather with us as we're talking to him about his life and career at CBS and in the news business. He's got an ebook out called Lessons from the Field. He's also got a number of other books out, including Courage Under Fire, his website, newsandgutsmedia.com. Spent some time looking at it. It's got some great things there. So, Dan, you did have this opportunity twice to interview Saddam Hussein. How did you guys pull that off? How did you get to interview him?
Well, one key to journalism reporting is persistence. And the first time, at the time of the first Gulf War, we had gone to the region. We actually did the CBS Evening News from the region. And I think our being persistent and also being in the region at the right time probably led to the first interview. The second interview, the fact that which happened just before the invasion of Iraq and what we call Gulf War II, again, I think we were persistent, but also because I'd interviewed him before, I think he must have said to his people, listen, I'm going to do one interview and one interview only, and while I didn't like this guy they sent the last time, at least I know who he is.
I know who he is.
I think that probably was the key. But I will say that, you know, before the break we were saying that if you've been in the room either time with Saddam Hussein, inescapable, you're dealing with a stone-cold killer. And the second thing, which I think is very important to understand, George, is that Saddam Hussein dreamed. His dream was to be the modern-day Saladin, you know, the great Arab conqueror of hundreds of years ago.
Yes, that's right.
And his dream was to lead a victorious Arab army through the streets of Jerusalem. That was his driving dream. And if you've been in the room with him for either one of the interviews, those two things would have come very clear to you or any other person who was interviewing.
He wasn't a Boy Scout, but he kept the lid and the stability in the Middle East, in that region, outside of his war with Iran. We supported him. I mean, I remember a picture of Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein, you know, as we supplied them chemicals.
Well, you're absolutely right, George. And I try not to diminish the coin of praise, but this is one reason your Coast to Coast program is so popular. Is because you're insightful. Saddam Hussein was a stone-cold killer, a very dangerous person, but there are a lot of such people around the world. And the decision to invade Iraq, without question, it was a strategic blunder of historical proportions. And the reason is because he was what was standing between the Iranian spread of influence in the Middle East. And the reason we supported him, President Reagan supported him during the 1980s, was because President Reagan realized that, saying, look, he's a bad guy, he's a terrible guy, runs a terrible government, is hell on these people. But he's the bulwark, being of Sunni Arab extraction, where most of the Iranians are Shiite and the ruling regime is Shiite in Iran. So Saddam Hussein was, in effect, helping to contain Iran. When we invaded and eventually ran him out, and that all collapsed. And so the big winner of Gulf War II, of our invasion of Iraq just after the turn of the millennium, the net effect of that is Iran was the big winner of that war, because look how influential they are.
That's right.
Tragically so in the Middle East today. So you put your finger right on something. Terrible as Saddam Hussein was, we had backed him during the 1980s because we understood that without him standing in the way of Iran, Iran's influence in the region and in many ways throughout the world would increase dramatically, which unfortunately it has.
Did we set him up, Dan? You know, he was concerned with Kuwait's slant drilling, taking what he thought was his oil. He goes to April Glaspie at the time, tells him he's concerned. Didn't she say to him, we're not getting involved in a Middle East dispute between you two nations, basically walking away from it? And he thought he had the go ahead from us.
Well, bingo, again, you put your finger right on a very important point. Yes, what you just described is pretty much what happened. And subsequent events, all this information got lost in the flood of the war that followed. But that's, in effect, we did give him the green light to do it. Whether we intended to do that, whether that was the intention of the ambassador or the intention of the U.S. administration's time or not, is not clear. But there's no question he took it that way. Now, I want to say, for fairness, perhaps he would have invaded Kuwait anyway. But the situation you describe is if the American ambassador went, he called her in, he said something about Kuwait, and she took that position saying, well, we have no position in that, as a rough paraphrase. And he unquestionably took that as a green light to invade Kuwait. There's a lot about that whole period, George. It still is not known. I hope I live long enough to see what future historians uncover about what happened, what really happened, as opposed to what some people want people to believe happened, what really happened during that period. Because, let's face it, we're still paying a very heavy price for the strategic blunder of going into Iraq. Wrong war, wrong place, wrong time.
Absolutely. And by the way, you still sound as young as you did when you were anchoring the CBS Evening News. You're going to be 85, aren't you?
I'll be 85 on October 31st.
You were born on Halloween?
I was born on Halloween.
Trick.
That may explain a lot. You know?
I love it. So much has gone on. I want to talk about your perspective on what's happening today as a newsman. We've got this horrendous situation with ISIS, which, and you know, again, you talk about us putting our finger on the pulse. It's very strange to me, Dan. I mean, a year and a half ago, we're watching video of all these ISIS people in the Middle East in caravans on roads in white Humvees, wearing their white tennis shoes, waving. And I'm wondering to myself, there's not one American fighter plane taking these guys out? I don't understand it. There's something weird here, and I can't figure it out. Have you figured it out yet?
George, I'd love to tell you I have. I have not. And if you find out the answer to that, please call me, collect.
I will do that.
I don't mean to make light of it, but, you know, this is a perilous time. There's a lot going on. The great geopolitical plates under the diplomatic earth are shifting in dramatic ways. That ISIS is a hell of a problem, no question about it. And your question about, well, couldn't we at least use our tremendous air power in some selected places other than back? But I'm not going to be critical of this administration, or for that matter, the previous administration, about how they've handled ISIS. Because we're in a situation we've never been in before. There, always before, you had nation states who were threatening us or other nation states, and that's what brought on combat and wars. Now, ISIS is not a nation. It's a movement. It's an Islamic movement that makes it very difficult to move, to deal with.
Yes.
But over and above that, and I think this is so important, George, that a loose federation is beginning to form of China, Russia, and Iran, all of whom are nation states. It's not a stated policy, but if you look the way they're moving, what they're trying to do is, in combination, those three major nations in combination are trying to build what they see as a counterbalance to U.S. power. So in addition to the ISIS, which is a form of threat that we've never really faced before, certainly not on this wider scale, you have this developing at the same time, this loose Iran, Russia, China, trying to, they don't have a written agreement, but if you watch what they're doing, they're trying to develop both a military and economic counterbalance to U.S. power.
And that concerns me.
Well, it should concern every American.
Yeah. And now we look at this presidential campaign, which for me is the strangest I have ever witnessed. I mean, it's just absolutely bizarre. I mean, Donald Trump, you got to give him credit for what he's doing. People are voting for him. And you're looking at the Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton situation. It's the weirdest election year I've ever seen, Dan.
Well, ditto for me. I've been covering presidential campaigns since 1952, if you can believe that. And I have never seen a campaign like this. And in addition, I'm fond of saying, you know, I have covered goat ropings and space shots.
Yeah.
I've never seen anything like this. But we have to, I'm not, again, preaching, but teaching, but a presidential election, it counts. It matters. And we have what we have. As of this moment, could change. Things in politics change quickly. It's Trump versus Hillary Clinton. And it does matter. I want to go on record as saying, I want to say this carefully, I'm not predicting that Donald Trump will win the election, but I'm here to tell you that his possibilities are real. He could win this election, whether you like him,
yep,
don't like him, or haven't made up your mind. I think it's very clear now. I've been saying this for months, but it's now comes clear. He can win in November. That's not to say he will win, but he can win in November, because you have this very strange situation that the candidates of each of the two major parties have the highest negatives in combination of anybody in the modern presidential campaign history. A lot of people who don't like either one of them. And so it's going to be interesting to see how it goes. Now, as a reporter, you've got to ask for a better story. And you bet I'll be at the Republican convention, the Democratic convention.
Good for you.
And I'm interested in covering it. But it's a very strange, even weird presidential campaign.
Because you're still doing some work now for the cable channel Access, aren't you?
I do. I do a weekly program. Mark Cuban, entrepreneur out of Dallas, who owns the Dallas Mavericks, owns this cable channel. And I've been doing a weekly news program for him. Now it's basically an interview program for almost 10 years. But, you know, I'm still active, and I do my best. I love reporting, and I wouldn't want to miss this election year.
Do you know Donald Trump personally?
Yes. I want to make clear, I'm not a dear friend of his, but I've known him, I think, since either the late 1970s or early 1980s on a, you know, reporter. Anybody in New York knew Donald Trump. Anybody in journalism knew Donald Trump. I did. He got very angry with me, under transparency, I should say, that, you know, in 2000, that's the race that wound up to be Gore versus Bush, he was making noises about running for president at that time. And I did a 60 Minutes 2 report about him, which he didn't like. And so things got a bit frosty after that. But yes, I know him, and I will tell you this about him. Again, whether you like him or don't like him, one, Donald Trump is smart. He brags about being smart, and that's not very attractive, but he is smart.
He'll tell you, right?
Oh, yeah, he'll tell you in a minute how great he is. But he is smart, and he is a strategic thinker. And I think people who discounted him at the beginning underestimated, it's now coming clear, his approach to the campaign has been strategic, because he is appealing to people, and not all of them are Republicans. He is appealing to what's out there in the country. Particularly people in the lower part of the economic strata. There's fear, there's resentment, there's distrust of Washington. Yes, there's some racial prejudice mixed in into a toxic mix. And Donald Trump speaks their language. He speaks to their fears, their resentments, their prejudices in a very effective way. And it would be a vast mistake to underestimate the potential for that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And how about Hillary? I'm sure you know her, too.
Oh, well, I do. I met Mrs. Clinton in, again, either late 1979, I think. But, again, I'm not a close friend of them, but if you do what I do, you're a journalist. And
you get to know these people.
Yeah, you get to know them. And Hillary Clinton, she's so much different in person than what she projects on television. Now, again, I'm not a campaigner for Hillary Clinton. I have my own reservations about her, as a matter of fact. But in person, she's a very personable personality. She relates to people very, very well. She listens. She's a very good listener in person. She also is smart. She's very smart. And you know, she worked all her life for this moment when she ran for president. So, you know, there it is. Now, the Hillary Clinton you see on television, someone could say, well, boy, that's not the Hillary Clinton I see. And I understand what they're saying, because she doesn't project on television the way anywhere near what she projects in a four-eyes basis person.
Right. Dan, would JFK, John F. Kennedy, had made it in the media world this time around? Because, you know, reporters are so aggressive these days. And, I mean, it's no secret that, you know, Kennedy was a womanizer. His administration supported assassinating other government leaders. There's several people that they went after. Two of them they got. They tried to get Fidel Castro. They did not. Would he make it as a politician today with his lifestyle?
What a good question. I think the answer is yes. Obviously, we deal with a hypothetical, and who can say? But John Kennedy, again, whether you like him or dislike him, agree with his policies. John Kennedy was charismatic, an overworked word, but apt in his case, a very good one-on-one politician and dynamite on television. Now, your question goes to, well, he had these secrets, which were not publicized at the time.
Deep secrets.
But I look at the case of Trump. Trump has, and I'm not, I don't mean this critically and opposing him, but Trump has got his personal history is not the kind of personal history that you'd expect a presidential candidate to have.
Right.
I'm trying to cite this gently. But since a Donald Trump can make it today with the baggage that he has, I think a John Kennedy would be, not only would he be effective, but he would be a tremendous campaigner today, because he wouldn't have to keep some of these secrets. For example, the womanizing. These days, remember, Nelson Rockefeller got knocked out of the presidential race for the nomination in 1964 because he was in the process of divorcing his wife.
Right, and Gary Hart knocked out his career.
Gary Hart got knocked out in 1986. These days, and this is the point, here we are in the second decade of the 21st century, and that kind of thing, not only does it not knock you out, but there's some present evidence that it might even help you. So with all of his personal political skills, a John Kennedy, a Ronald Reagan, the kind of candidates who have a certain magic about them, my contention is they would do good at any time and any circumstance.
Isn't it amazing? And through it all, Fidel Castro is still around. Through everything, he has seen so many governmental leaders come and go.
He has indeed. There are indications that, you know, he's about to take another journey, but your point is well taken. As you may know, I've interviewed Castro not recently, but I've interviewed him, six times over the years. And he is amazing. In person, he's amazing. Again, I know there are people who don't want to hear that. But Fidel Castro, we talk about a John Kennedy, a Ronald Reagan having a certain charisma and magic. If Fidel Castro had been born in a bigger country, he would be a leader of some kind. Now, because, one, he's smart, but also he has an intuitive way about how to touch people emotionally. And, again, I'm not his campaign manager, and he's done terrible things in Cuba. He's been terrible for Cuba. But any way you cut it, you have to perhaps grudgingly give him credit.
Did he not turn to us first, Dan, for help and support, and we turned him down?
He did. This was during the very late stages of the Eisenhower administration. That's true, that he led the revolution. The revolution succeeded, and he came. He came to New York and stayed at a hotel up in Harlem, and he was asking for support. Now, in fairness and in context, one has to say that the fear of the Eisenhower administration was he was asking for our support, but in his heart of hearts, he was a Marxist, Leninist, soul communist.
Ah.
And that was the reason given. History will have to judge whether, if we had given him support and fell in support of him, would he have taken the island into a Marxist, Leninist dictatorship or not?
Dan, stay with us. We're going to come back and wrap things up and take some phone calls with you next. Dan Rather has been our guest. We've got one more segment with him as we talk about his ebook, which you can take and get, Lessons from the Field. Newsandgutsmedia.com is the site. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you along with Dan Rather. We'll get to your calls in just a second here for the remaining half hour that we have. As we were talking about Fidel Castro and how he kind of turned to us for help when he took over and got Batista out. Batista was not a Boy Scout, Dan, was he?
No. He certainly was not a Boy Scout. And in his way, he ruled the island with the battle's iron fist, as Castro has done. Don't miss an insanity. He was not a Marxist-Leninist, but he was mob-connected. It was not a good situation for the Cuban people, which is the reason that they revolted and overthrew the Batista regime. It's a complicated period in their history and is ours, but fair to say that the United States backed the Batista regime, knowing full well that it was corrupt and dictatorial.
I wonder, how did Castro feel about, you know, the fact that we tried to have the CIA kill him right after, you know, that situation, the Bay of Pigs was going on during the Eisenhower administration. Kennedy used it quickly in his campaign, and Nixon couldn't say anything about it. So it made Kennedy look like Mr. Tough Guy on foreign policy. But did Castro ever say to you when you chatted with him that, you know, why are these people out to kill me?
Well, yes, he didn't ask the question as a rhetorical question. He just stated it as a fact several times, and it was pointed out that we had indeed made assassination attempts with him. I would say by the time I first interviewed Castro in the mid-1970s, and by that time, he was well-established, his dictatorship was well-established, his connection. At that time, he was a staunch ally of the old Soviet Union and the Soviets. And by that time, I would say the number one thing he professed not to understand about the United States, and he said this several times, he didn't understand why Americans of African heritage had not revolted against the U.S. government. Now, to me, that said that as much as Fidel Castro knew about the United States, and he knew a lot about our country, that he didn't understand the DNA, he didn't understand the ethos of the country. And certainly it was true then, as it's true now, that Americans of African heritage have a lot to complain about and to worry about. But what he missed was the connection between African-American communities, whole of this country, and Christianity. But that's the kind of thing that he talked about. He also was deeply committed to the idea, George, and this is pointed out through, I think a lot of people don't understand about Castro, that I thought for a long time that he perhaps had developed his relationship with the Soviet Union and gone into communism, not really believing in his system, but believing it was the only thing in which he could survive against the United States. But he finally convinced me that he is the last person on the planet who believes in Marxism-Leninism as an economic system. You know, the argument for it is a system of justice is one thing, but it's failed economically everywhere in the world. But for a long time, I just thought, well, you know, he's mouthing the words, but he doesn't really believe in this economic system. But I came to believe I was wrong about that, that he may be the last person walking who actually believes in it as an economic system. And he does now in his dotage and ill health. Make no mistake, he still deeply believes it.
Fascinating. Let's take some final calls here for you, Dan. Let us pick it up by going to Jim in Kansas City, Missouri on the wildcard line. Jim, welcome to the show. You're on with Dan Rather.
Thank you, George. Dan, it's a pleasure to get to talk to you. An honor, sir. I have two questions, and please respond to the second one especially. But the first one I want to ask you, after all that's happened since the JFK assassination and all the research and the movie and all that, do you still believe in the lone gunman theory alone? And secondly, please tell this story, because I've been in radio 29 years myself. Tell the story when you were starting out in Texas and you had a religious program running on your station on a Sunday morning, and you took off to go down the street to get an ice cream cone for a few minutes, and talk about that little mishap with the record.
Well, first of all, it's good to talk to you, Jim, and I compliment you on your career in radio. The second story, I know you won't tell it, but it takes too long to tell. Let me deal with the first, that on the Kennedy assassination. Listen, as a reporter, you learn to beware of certitude. But my opinion you know, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, and you're not entitled to your own facts. I believe that the evidence is overwhelming that Lee Harvey Oswald was a shooter and was the only shooter. I recognize that there are people who have different views. If that's from my view, I think Oswald was the only shooter there. I do think that on the conspiracy question, well, if he was the only shooter, was anybody else involved with him? I'm open-minded about it. Things may come up in future years, but I'll say now, the weight of the evidence on that is that while the other, no doubt other people had known Oswald, I don't believe that anybody was conspiring with him on the assassination. The Warren Commission made a lot of mistakes. It was not perfect by any means. Obviously, they kept the investigation going for much longer, but I do. You've asked me my opinion, and my opinion is Oswald was a shooter. He was the lone shooter, and no, I don't think there was any conspiracy. I don't think there was any conspiracy, anybody, any group of people, or any one people, a person putting him up to it. As for the story about the going to the ice cream cone, it was just the record got stuck, and the preacher was saying, go to hell, go to hell, go to hell, because the record got stuck, and it almost cost him my job.
And
probably the best I can do on the second part.
I remember a Larry King story when he was spinning records down in Miami, and we, of course, have taken over his late-night spot here. He had a call from a little sweetheart, and he decided to play the longest record he could, and off he went. And he gets to her house, turns on the radio just to hear it, and it's skipping. So back he had to go. Let's go to some more calls. David's in Chicago. David, welcome to the program. You're on the air with us. Hi, David.
Hello, George. Dan Rather, you're an institution of this country, and it's a tremendous honor to get a chance to speak with you. I have a question that's kind of a few things all wrapped up in one. I'll make it as quick as I can.
Sure.
Do you believe, with all your years of experience, that the elections are really in the hands of the people? Because if you look at the situation, for example, with Hillary Clinton get involved in selling uranium to foreign countries while she was Secretary of State, and there's even talk, I've heard some stories, that she may have been involved in the demise of JFK Jr. Is the elections really to appease us, or are they real? And I'll hang up for your answer on the air, sir. Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you for the question, and thank you for your kind words. There's a lot in that question. Let me deal with first, are the results of the election or the results of the will of people? As flawed as the electoral college system is, I think the answer to that is yes. I recognize it's probably not the answer you're looking for, but I think in the end, most of the time in presidential elections, the will of the people prevails. Now, the system is badly flawed and needs reform. That's another subject for another time. Is the electoral college the best way to elect a president now in the 21st century? It may have been in the late 1700s or in the 1800s. To ask the question is not to say to you that I know the answer of it, but I think the answer is we can still have confidence in the results of presidential elections. Now, I am worried about the electronic voting machines. Again, another subject.
Absolutely.
For another day. That these machines are not what they purport to be. There are a lot of flaws in them, and they can be manipulated. Whether they have already been manipulated enough to swing an election, I don't feel qualified to say, but I do say if you want to concentrate on something that can be fixed, is to run deep questions on these electronic voting machines. As for the other speculations and rumors that you mentioned, I would just say, you know, as a reporter, I get paid to deal with facts. And on the specific things that you raised, the facts are few, the rumors are many.
Dan, we've interviewed a woman by the name of Bev Harris, who heads up blackboxvoting.com. She is convinced that these electronic voting machines can be rigged, tapped into, hacked, changed, manipulated. It's a scary thing.
Well, there's no doubt that it can be done. We did an investigative report on, Dan Rather reports on Access TV some years ago. There's absolutely no question that they can be hacked, and it's surprisingly, they can be hacked very quickly by people who understand how they work. The major question is, have they been already manipulated, and has that affected the past elections? I don't find any convincing evidence that it has happened, but there's not nearly enough attention paid to the potential of hacking in and corrupting the whole electoral process through these electronic voting machines. The electronic voting machines, in many cases, I'm sorry to say, they're just a racket, a money-making racket, and they're not nearly what they're reported to be. But not anybody in power really wants to hear that. But it's very important that people understand that these machines can be hacked into, and quite quickly and rather easily, for people who know what they're doing.
Let's go to the international line now. We will go to Jesse in Vancouver, Canada. Jesse, welcome to the show. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, George.
Sure.
Dan, you called Gulf War II strategic blunder of historic proportion. It appears to me that the Obama administration did not learn any lessons from that blunder, although it was committed by a different party. They committed a similar blunder, of course, not of that bigger proportion, but still fairly significant in Libya. And if Hillary Clinton had continued in the second Obama administration, I believe the same mistake would have been committed in Syria. Right now, the only thing that's saving the 10% Christian population, one of the oldest churches in Christianity in Syria, is the present administration. The moment Sunni form the government, they will be decimated. Hillary, I remember her saying, Assad has to go. That would have been the third disaster. The Obama administration tried doing their best to the fourth disaster in Egypt. George is a Coptic Christian, except he's fairly secular. He does not understand, or I apologize to saying that, that the Coptic Christians in Egypt would have been decimated if the Mohammed Morsi administration had continued. For some reason, I see a lot of very knowledgeable people come even on George's program, especially Bloom, who understands Islam and can draw some lessons from the past history, but it does not appear that the administrations are learning that lesson.
How about a question, Jesse, though? Go ahead.
No, sorry. The question is, can you explain this, I don't know whether it's deliberate or accidental, blindness of the successive administrations who have not learned any lessons even from Iraq?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the question. I think the best I can do in trying to answer the question is a long succession of American administrations, both Democratic and Republican, continue to make the same mistake over and over and over again, and that is not to understand the historical context in which situations occur, don't understand the culture, don't understand the underpinnings of unrest and discontent in country after country, region after region. And it goes back even further, but you can start, we made this mistake in Vietnam, we made it going into Iraq. And answer your question, I don't think it's deliberate, but it is disheartening that time after time, whether the president, whether the administration be Republican or Democratic, that they don't understand these things that are right before, the culture of the country, the historical context in which it's happening. And blunder is the only word I can think of. We continue to make the blunder. That's the best I can do in trying to answer your question.
We'll take a few more questions, and then we are out of time with Dan Rather. Dan, when's the last time you stayed up at 3 in the morning doing a radio show?
Well, you know, it's often said, George, that politicians, hangmen, and reporters do their best work after midnight.
Yep, that is so true. I hope you don't have to get up early Saturday, that's for sure. Let's go to Austin, Texas. Fred, welcome to the program. Go ahead, Fred.
Dan, it's really an honor to talk to you again. You interviewed me in October 1969. I was a Navy corpsman with Dixie Dine and Recon team with the Marines, and had just let off a wounded Marine at a MASH unit surgical hospital, and I was really privileged to interview.
What a small world.
It's a very small world. He's still living in Smithville.
You know, my wife is from Winchester, Texas, which is not far from Smithville, and her parents, who are now deceased, we still have relatives in Smithville, and I go there at least two or three times a year. And Fred, it's good to talk to you, and it's very kind of you to remember all the way back to 1969 in Vietnam.
Well, it's one of those rare instances you never forget when you're over there. What were your most vivid memories of Vietnam, and what did you think of the men and women who served and fought and died in that war?
Well, first of all, different people can have different opinions about the U.S. involvement in Vietnam, but my time there deeply ingrained in me this. Listen, we may have gone to those who fought the Vietnam War, they may have gone to the wrong war in the wrong place at the wrong time, but they went for the right reasons. Number one, they went because they loved their country. Number two, they went because we, the people of the United States and our leadership, asked them to go. And it's always been, it's still painful to me. Things have changed as regarding military service, but
yes,
it's always painful
true.
To me that some people took it out on the people who fought the war. What they should have been doing is taking out on the leadership. But I came out of the coverage of Vietnam combat tremendously impressed by the patriotism of the people who fought it. So you can argue about whether the war was the right war or not, but you can't argue about the valor and sacrifice of the men and women who fought it.
Dan, you're so right. So right. I mean, I spent 9 years with the Navy, and during that era where I was in college, people hated the military and the soldiers, and they booed them and they cursed them when they came home from Vietnam, rather than question the war, which they're entitled to do. But don't attack our military people. I mean, that's their role, whether they want to go or not. I mean, I knew a lot of guys who went to Vietnam. They didn't want to go, but they went because they were in our military.
And we asked them to go. George, it's been such a pleasure to be with you. I'm going to try to fish sometime tomorrow. If I'm going to catch any fish, I can't sleep too late.
All right, you get some sleep. And, of course, your book, your e-book, they can go to your website, newsandgutsmedia.com. And can they download the e-book from there, Lessons from the Field?
They can.
Great. Dan?
It will take them to a site where they can do so.
I love it.
And, George, again, thank you so much for having me on. I've enjoyed it, and I appreciate your having me with you.
We'll be in touch. Dan Rather, just a superb human being who just called it the way he saw it. I'm going to come back in a moment and call it the way I see it with your open lines on Coast to Coast. Couple hours of open lines. It's, well, if it's Saturday morning where you are, it is now full moon open lines here on Coast to Coast AM. Also, don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and email me whenever you want at george@coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a moment. Get ready for open lines.